Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Good evening, listeners. Thanks for tuning in to the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show. I'm Rosita DeJesus, and I'm joined by my co-host and brother in martial arts, Sifu Robert Eel. Sifu Ba, how you doing this evening?
Good, good. For a change, it's a little chilly in L.A., but I guess tonight I can't say much about... Yeah, I know. That sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it?
I know, chilly in L.A., yeah. 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 So how cold is it over there? I mean, are we talking like what? Is 40 cold for you guys or?
Yeah, 40 is pretty cold for us.
Oh yeah, well it's about that with us too. So yeah. So anyway, listeners, we've got a great show for everyone today. Our call in number here is 347-677-0699, and we have a great show with a wonderful guest. In fact, I'm going to pass the mic off to Sifu Robert so that way he can introduce our guest so our special guest can join us for our news and fitness shout-outs and stuff. So on to you, Bob.
Absolutely. You know what? I've been looking forward to this show all week long.
Yeah,
this
you have.
Absolutely. like we haven't talked about it for like the last week solid.
I know, every day I'm so excited.
Every day I've been emailing, texting, talking on the phone, and until she had to tell me to go away is how bad it got. But this is absolutely my best friend on the planet. We have been friends since we were 28, so it's been 20 years ago. I've known his daughter since she was 3. We've done magazines together. In fact, the anniversary of our first magazine cover together is February. It's been 18 years. We've been in 4 videos together that he starred in, magazines, you name it. Please help me welcome Master Stokey, Grandmaster, my closest friend in the entire world, Greg Wooldridge.
Right, thank you very much. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We're really honored and really happy to have you on. So now, because you've actually been introduced at the beginning of the show, that means you get to be kind of like another co-host in a way.
Yeah, I love it.
So yeah, it's kind of cool because we normally start off all of our shows with a little bit of health and fitness news, some Facebook shout outs, and Bob's segment, which I really like, Bob's weird news. All of our guests are welcome to comment and kind of be a co-host with us and stuff like that. So with that said, I do want to remind our listeners, of our phone number here, 347-677-0699. And to also remind our listeners that if you like this show and, you want to get regular updates about upcoming guests and shows, check out our Facebook page. It's, facebook.com/ Dynamic Dojo. And let me double check on that. Yes, Dynamic Dojo. And we also have a an actual website for the Seika Network, which is where this show is coming through. It's in the works still. It's an ongoing project. And our website there is Seika Network. That's SEIKANETWORK, Seika Network .webs.com. And if for some reason I gave you that wrong URL or whatever, just look up Seika Network, S-E-I-K-A Network, and yeah, you'll find us. All right. So with that said, let's go on to our health and fitness news.
I want to bring up something real fast.
What's that?
I have found out this week that you are certifiably nuts. Tell me just briefly about, you know where I'm going with this.
Yes,
tell me briefly about the Aki Polar Bear Plunge.
Okay, so I was posting on Facebook on my personal profile that me and some of the members from my studio, Seattle Wushu Center, and from our sister studio, the Seattle Filipino Martial Arts Academy, we are meeting on Alki Beach here in West Seattle, and we're going to do the polar bear plunge. And it's a tradition that's been going on in other countries such as Sweden, I believe, and many other countries where it's really, really freaking cold. And we're following that tradition, and this tradition has been going on in the Seattle area for, I forget how many years now. I'm guessing it's been close to a decade since someone actually brought this tradition back to Seattle. But there's several of these polar bear plunges in the city of Seattle, and my students and colleagues are going to be doing the one at Alki Beach. And everyone gathers around at Alki Beach at 9:45, and there's a countdown. And at 10 a.m. sharp, everyone just dives into the Puget Sound, just dives into the water. And you can stay in there as long as you want, or you can just go in and get the heck out of Dodge.
That would be me.
Well, I'm in Chicago, and it's pretty cold out here. So thinking about a plunge in the Puget Sound, that's got my nerves working.
You know, it's like I've only done one shugyo training when New Year's came. I did a special karate training and aikido training come New Year's, and it was crazy. It was like, you know, 100 throws and all this other kind of stuff, 1,000 punches, and you know, and then getting sprayed by ice cold water and New Year's, you know, to purge. Ooh. The old year, right? And I think this particular tradition is based on that, to purge the old year and to cleanse the body for the coming year. But this year we're going to have fun with it. We did last year too. And our theme that we're going to be working with this year is we're all going to dress up like Vikings. And we're going to jump into the Puget Sound.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I got my Viking hat and my Viking costume yesterday, so I'm all set.
You are a warrior, Stina. You are a warrior.
Ah, I'm set. So, yeah, that's that. So, yeah, Sifu Bob thinks I'm certifiably nuts.
I think I might agree with him just a little bit.
We'll see what happens. I thought it was not nuts last year, but then the adrenaline rush that you get from it, and it stays with you for a good few hours, that rush of you know, going in there and bringing in a new year with like 1,000 other people. It's amazing. So we'll see what happens tomorrow.
I'll call you on Wednesday and hear you in front of your TV with your Theraflu.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm cold.
I'm so cold. I got the flu. All right. Well, let's get on with our news. Yeah. Before we get to health and fitness news, I almost forgot. I wanted to do a couple of Facebook shout outs to the people that made some great contributions to the Facebook group page, the Dynamic Dojo Facebook group page. I want to put a shout out there and a thank you to Master Rob Buckland. He's got a great blog called Fearless Fitness Martial Arts. And if you want to check out his blog, it's at Fears LTD. That's all one word, fearsltd.blogspot.com. And he's got a really wonderful post this week about the anatomy of courage. And it's got a wonderful poem it's got a wonderful quote by Joe Lewis that goes over the anatomy of courage. But it's also a remembrance and a dedication to Vicky Soto. And she was one of the teachers that were killed at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. She literally basically stood in front of her kids and told the killer that they were somewhere else and stood in front of him to no matter what would happen. And you know, it's a great blog post because and a great remembrance to her, because you know, let's face it, you know, even as martial artists, if we were, you know, facing an unprovoked attack like that, it all depends on our training to find out how we react in a situation where, you know, literally the shit hits the fan, pardon my French. And this woman was not trained in anything. The only thing she was trained on was how she cared for those kids and protecting those kids with her life. And, you know, blessings to Vicky Soto. You know, we hope she's in a better place. So, but anyway, check out his blog. He's got a really great blog, Mr. Buckland does. So really great stuff. I'd also like to thank Elastic Steel, who's got a really great YouTube channel. So if you just look up Elastic Steel on YouTube, and Elastic Steel has great demonstrational videos and wonderful informational information on how to stretch correctly and how to do exercises correctly. This week, it's about a very common abdominal exercise, and it warns if you do it wrong, you can seriously injure your back. So check out that. All these links are on the Dynamic Dojo radio show page, so feel free to check it out on Facebook. We also have Kevin Mills, who's got a website called KevinMillsMartialArtsExpert.com. Great website. Thank you so much, Mr. Mills, for submitting your website. And this week, his latest post is about performing under stress. What is stress? Can we perform while under stress? Great information there. So go ahead and check out KevinMillsMartialArtsExpert.com. And that's it for my Facebook shout out. Yay, Facebook, shout out. All right, very quickly, because I do want to, have plenty of time for talking to Soke Greg. So for our health and fitness news, I want to talk a little bit about fatigue. Not necessarily only chronic fatigue syndrome, which, by the way, more women actually struggle with more so than men, but even then, chronic fatigue syndrome does apply to both men and women. And what I just want to do is go over just a few strategies on how to keep your energy up all day, every day. And I got this link off of health.com, and the full text of the link is also on the Dynamic Dojo radio show. I'm only going to touch on a few things here, but if you want the full write-up and stuff, go check it out on the on our group page. So one of the things that really messes us up, and I'm guilty of this too, is hitting the snooze button. Okay. I want to ask all our listeners, raise your hand if you hear the alarm go off and you hit that snooze button. I'm pretty sure about 95% of people are going to raise their hand, right? Yeah. And actually, you know, I always wonder why it always messes with me. Why am I tired? You know, the whole rest of the day. Well, it's because when you go back to sleep, it interrupts your hormone cycle and it makes it harder for you to get going. It's suggested that you just set your alarm for just 15 minutes later. If you know you're going to get up at 6 o'clock, just set it for, you know, 15 minutes later, because, you know, who really sets up their alarm knowing that they're going to get up right when it rings? I don't either. Yeah.
No.
You know, what do? You set it for early, so you're kind of awake, and then you snooze until you go, oh crap, I really need to get up now, right? That's what a lot of us do, and that can really hurt our hormone cycle, because it's actually fooling our body into thinking that, okay, we're up, now we're asleep again. So it'll mess around with our circadian rhythms, And another suggestion they have is that if you really, really, really want to get up, put your alarm clock across the room. So you have to get up to get it. Now, I did that too, but I just got really good at throwing slippers. So, you know, that didn't help. All right. The second big thing, which I'm guilty of, is not eating breakfast. It's really suggested you have to eat breakfast. You know, when we're at night, when we're sleeping at night, we're starving ourselves, basically.
Absolutely.
And, you know, during that time, we experience these spikes in these hormones, cortisol, and for guys, testosterone, you know, and women's hormones and stuff. And these spikes, you know, can get out of whack unless we stabilize with breakfast.
Well, you know, breakfast means to break the fast. So
exactly.
You're right. You're fasting when you sleep. So you sleep for 8 hours. Your body's not taking in any nourishment. And what happens is that your liver pumps out sugars throughout the night. Your body goes through all the changes. So it's fasting through the night. So when you eat breakfast, you're actually breaking the fast. And starting that process in the right way to start the day. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, and here's a hard one, and I'm pretty sure my friends in Alaska have a problem with this, is another suggestion to make sure that your body's circadian rhythms actually get back into the swing of things is to let in light. Doesn't matter if it's artificial or natural, but, you know, as we all know, light helps optimize our body's wake-up processes. And whether that involves, depending on the season, whether that involves rolling up the shades or if it's still dark outside, just turning on the lights, you know, it's suggested that you allow the light to work. Now, it's suggested that if you're going to use indoor light or fluorescent bulbs, that you use fluorescent bulbs that are labeled cool white or daylight. Not only because they're good for recycling, but these compact fluorescent bulbs with these particular color temperatures emit a white light that's closer to outdoor light than the weird yellow kind from incandescent bulbs. So, and that I found out about a couple years ago. So my whole home actually has cool white fluorescent bulbs as opposed to the nasty ones that give you a headache.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, during the day, though, now this is something I'm guilty of, too. In fact, all of these I need to really work on is I tend to stay glued in my chair a lot when I'm doing marketing, email correspondence, website edits, and, you know, and sometimes I'll just sit in place for literally 4 hours at a time, and that's a no-no. Apparently, you want to work in chunks. You need occasional movement to get oxygen flowing and your blood moving and to get your muscles going and stuff. And before we actually had to move to our temporary space now, you know, it came in handy to have the dojo floor just like 3 steps away from my office. So, you know, it was really cool to be able to go, oh, crap, I need to take a break and go out and do Tai Chi, you know, or hit on the kicking shield for a while, you know, and then go, okay, I'm good, and I'm back to work. But for the last couple of months, I found that kind of hard to do. And this was a great reminder to me and a memory jogger for me to actually take time to take breaks. So hopefully our listeners will take that into consideration too, no matter what your occupation is. All right. Yeah. And last but not least, and there's a lot more, but last but not least, it is suggested that you understand your late night cravings. Now, late at night when you want a snack, they say that it usually means you're sleepy, not hungry. It means that you've kept your brain awake too long, and it needs a glucose hit to stay awake. So, you know, when it's like 3 a.m. and you're like, oh, I'm hungry, it's you know, chances are it's really your body telling you you're sleepy, get the hell to sleep. So,
right.
Anyhow, yeah. So that was just a few of our healthy tips on how to keep your energy all day, every day. And the full write-up is on the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show group page on Facebook. So go check it out to get that full write-up. Yay.
Well, Sifu, that was definitely the Reader's Digest version, because, you know, I printed out 10 pages of notes for
yeah.
the show tonight, and 7 pages of that was the write-up on this health news.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
Like, holy
well,
crap.
Yeah, well, when I first pulled it up on health.com, I went through the first couple pages, and I went, okay, I'll print it. So I copied it, and then when it printed out, it came out as like 10 pages, and I'm like, oh, crap, I'm not going to do all of them. I'm just going to pick. So I picked the ones that I thought, you know, most everyone had heard about, but, you know, but just needed to hear again as a nice reminder. So, and hey, you know, because everyone's gotten that cool, energizing advice, they're gonna be awake to hear Bob's weird news. So
that's right. And, you know, and they are gonna be awake. Now I picked this week since Sophie Gray is a retired police officer, I picked World's Dumbest Criminal.
Sweet.
Now
do it.
The
I
first
love
story
it. I love it.
The first story is really funny. because I was watching World's Dumbest Criminals one night on True TV, oh, years ago. Now, picture this, Oki. You walk into a liquor store to grab a cup of coffee. You're in line, full uniform, badge, gun, pepper spray, taser, the whole bit. Everybody knows you're a cop. You're just, there's one person in front of you. This person pulls a knife and decides he's going to hold up the liquor store with you standing right behind him. The cop took one step back and drew down on him. It was funny because this guy was so stupid.
Well, it's funny because I guarantee you the cop didn't know whether to laugh or whether to smash the guy. You know,
I know, right? Now, what would you have done?
He deserved it.
It's okay. What would you have done?
That is hilarious.
Would you have laughed at him or just, you know, like taking the gun away from him?
I would have taken him at his word and handled him quickly. But afterward, I definitely would have given him a chuckle or two.
Right. Yeah, right? You kind of like, you know, rip the gun away from him and go, son, that was stupid. I mean,
yeah, you know, hey, once the handcuffs are on, then he would have got a couple laughs, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, up to that point, it was all business.
Oh, my God.
Now,
so,
for this week, though, I've got a topper.
Okay.
World's dumbest criminal holds up police officer inside a police station.
What? What?
Wait. Wow.
Wow.
You know, people never cease to amaze me. Never.
This grabbed my eye, and I went, I got to do this one. A teenager in Texas told the cops he was just kidding when he walked into a Wilmer police department last week and told an officer to hand over his money. This young man wasn't using his head for sure. Police Chief Victor Kemp said, you hear of those world's dumbest criminals every once in a while, but you never think it's going to happen in your city. 18-year-old Keith Emanuel, who attempted to hold up the officer while a towel was over his hand, quickly realized where he was and what he was doing and tried to change the subject, telling the policewoman he was there to check on a warrant. Perhaps realizing he wasn't about to get let off the hook, Manuel decided to go for broke and told the officer, you do know I have a gun. He was...
Wow.
Wow.
Amazing.
He was promptly arrested and booked into Dallas County Jail, where he remains charged with several crimes, the most serious of which being robbery. I didn't say, this is the weird part, I didn't say nothing like that, word for word. I swear to God, I didn't say nothing like that.
That's why they
didn't find no guns on me. Manuel later told the local CBS affiliate over the phone, man, I play like that all the time. I didn't think she would take it. Oh, my God.
Jesus. Darwin Award.
Well,
I tell you what's
a little bit scary is that those are the type of people that sometimes do some of the really horrific things. And they're just out of touch. And as funny as it can be sometimes after the fact, sometimes you walk away from those encounters and you're just shaking your head saying, you know, I'm thanking God that it was only like this that he expressed it. Because had he done it another way, it could have been far, far worse. So, you know, it's a spooky thing. It can be funny, it can be crazy, but it can be a little spooky, too, when you see that guy or that gal on the wrong side of what they're doing.
That's right.
Absolutely. He didn't even realize where he was. I would have him go through a psychiatric evaluation, for sure.
Well, you know what? Absolutely. You know, That's really what the psychiatric eval is all about, is are you a danger to yourself, or are you a danger to others, or are you gravely disabled? There's really three elements to that type of mindset. And, you know, and what happens is that people don't realize how many people really are just a little off kilter that are walking the streets, and how many people just in the wrong frame of mind, they just can do some really crazy things.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Crazy.
Now, this is my little weird laws thing, which, you know, I brought up a few weeks ago, and
I love it.
People loved it. You know, the weird laws, Stokey, about, you know, you can't sit on the sidewalk, can't bowl on Sundays, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So these are all from Connecticut. In Hartford, Connecticut, all balloons with advertising are considered illegal. You can't market your business by using balloons.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
I wonder why that is.
Hartford must be a weird city, because in Hartford, it's illegal for a man to kiss his wife on Sunday.
What?
Well, that sucks.
Oh, that makes no sense.
Whoever came up with that law was not a happily married man or woman, okay? It just doesn't seem to be.
Well, here's another one. This one's for, like, the Jackie Chans of the world. In Hartford, it is illegal to cross the street while walking on your hands.
Wow. I'm going to leave that one alone. I'm just going to leave that one alone.
Now, this next one, I actually put in parentheses when I sent it to Sifu. And insert joke here at Greg's expense. So,
wait till he hears it.
In Waterford, Connecticut, it is illegal for a beautician to hum, whistle, or sing while working on a customer. And at that moment in time, I figured out why Sophie's bald.
Yeah,
a humming
musician. Oh, you go there. You went there, Sifu. Wow.
The musician was humming, and all of a sudden, Toki here. Oh crap!
So this is assuming that beauticians over there in Waterford or Waterbury, because my notes say Waterbury.
It is Waterbury.
So somehow, some way, sometime for this law to come into action, there had to have been some esthetician or beautician that could not walk and chew gum, much less sing and hold shears, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
That's funny. Oh, my gosh. Awesome. Wow. Those were cool, weird laws. I love it. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to, like, I look forward to this every week. I don't know why. I like hearing about weird laws. Right on. Well, I think it's time for the trivia question of the week. Woohoo.
Yeah,
so for our listeners out there, just to remind everyone, every week we've got a trivia question. And for fun, if you are the first caller, if I pick up the phone and you're on it and you want to answer the question, if you're the first caller that has the correct answer, you get to win bragging rights. And you also get to win the opportunity, if you'd like, to be a guest co-host with me and Sifu Bob on an upcoming show. Now, I do know and think that I should probably get a different prize for that, but this is all I can afford right now. So, and besides, it's really fun to be a guest co-host with me and Sifu Bob, you know? It's pretty
Absolutely.
Cool. Yeah. So here is our trivia question of the week. The world's biggest what was made in London in 1998 to celebrate the re-release of Disney's Lady and the Tramp? And I'll repeat that. So the question again is, the world's biggest what was made in London in 1998 to celebrate the re-release of Disney's Lady and the Tramp? Our guest call-in number here is 347-677-0699. And if you are the first caller that would like to answer this this question, just let us know. In fact, we've got a caller right now. This is a caller
well,
from...
Well, actually, Sifu, I want to say something first.
Sure.
I want to say that the answer is not big, the world's biggest dog turd. That's all I got to say.
The world's biggest dog turd. Yeah, it's the world's biggest what? What was made in its biggest form in London in 1998 to celebrate the re-release of Disney's Lady and the Tramp? Now, for callers for today, what I'm going to be doing is when I answer the phones, I'm going to be calling out your last four digits of your phone number, okay? So, for example, I might say, you know, hi, caller from 0699. If that's your phone number, then I'm talking to you, not anybody else, okay? All right, so it looks like we have a caller from 2786. Welcome to the Dynamic Dojo radio show, 2786. What can we do for you? 2786, caller 2786.
Is that me?
Yeah, I think that's you.
2786. Oh, sorry, my last three digits. I'm sorry. I was like,
yeah.
Man, I'm sorry. I you know, it's an off day. This is Alan Woodman.
Oh, hey.
Alan.
How are
you? Hey, guys. How you doing?
Pretty good.
I have to apologize because I often miss your show. It's an hour after mine, and I'm still doing all my other promotion shows, you know, promotion stuff and
yeah,
working on
yeah,
other
shows.
The show is done. You guys know what it's like right after you finish, so you got to do all this other stuff. So I apologize for I try to catch a show when I can, but tonight I didn't have a show. It's our one time of the year that we didn't have a show yet. So I just wanted to take the day off because New Year's is tomorrow.
Right on. Yeah.
To answer your question, if I'm not mistaken, it was the largest bowl of spaghetti, right?
Woo-hoo! Yay!
Ding, 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 ding.
Ding, 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 ding. Woo! Okay. So that means Alan gets to join us on... So that means
nice.
You can do shows in a row, basically, right?
With an hour break.
With an hour break, just enough to eat dinner, and then we get to call you. That's awesome.
Exactly.
Yay. So this is awesome. So Sensei Alan Woodman wins to be a guest co-host. I don't, you know, it's nothing new to Sensei Woodman because he's already the host of Sidekick Talk Radio, which is another show. Listeners, you guys should look up. So, but it'll be fun. I've done the back-to-back shows before. It's interesting. To say the least,
I actually did in one day. I actually did. I did three radio shows in one day. I did. Dan Heck's Kicking It Old School.
Mm-hmm.
Right after that, I did. That was out in California. I did Sisters with Harmony, which is a talk show here in Philadelphia. And then I ended up doing my own show that night. That's a busy day. That was my whole day of work right there.
Oh, man. Gee whiz, that is a long day. Well, awesome. Yeah. Yay. Thanks for hitting that number one button to let me know that you wanted to get on there. Because, you know, I saw your number up on there, and I'm like, oh, we'll just wait. And then, boop. A little question mark popped up. I'm like, oh, well, I think somebody wants to answer the question. That'll be cool.
There you go.
Awesome. Nah, well, congrats, Sensei Woodman, for getting the opportunity. Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
I'll be honest with you. I actually am very excited. You and I have been chatting online, actually, over the last week about the upcoming show.
Right.
About the getting the... What are you calling the show now exactly?
It's like a BTR, a Blog Talk Radio martial arts show hosts, and
right.
We're going to be featuring this on Grandmaster Daryl Sargent's Modern Combat Masters. Since
right.
I'm a co-host on that particular show as well, Grandmaster
right.
Daryl had this great idea for just getting some of the martial art show hosts together
right.
and just kind of doing like a rap and stuff. I'm not quite sure, you know, what type of questions he wants to ask, but, you know, I sure want to, you know, talk a little bit to other show hosts. So, you know, you'll be on there. Soke Hassan Khalid's going to be on there. I think Grandmaster Daryl is talking to a few other people, me and Bob. It'll be fun.
I'll make sure Alan gets on the show. How's that?
There you go. Yeah. Why don't we do that?
I'll make sure Alan Goldberg comes on the show.
Very cool. Now, speaking of which, since I have you on the line, is this number that you're calling from, is that a good number to call you at?
You can call me on that anytime you want, just not when my girlfriend's around. She gets kind of jealous. You know how it is.
I guess we better make sure that your girlfriend knows that you're going to be like on a show from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
She's shaking her head. She's like, I don't even care now.
Right. All right. Let's go ahead and just Sensei Woodman, do you want to stay on the line to listen?
I would love to if I could.
Awesome. All right. Well, I'll go
absolutely.
Ahead and put your mic on
thank
mute
you,
for
Renchi.
A little bit. Yeah, we'll go ahead and put your mic on mute here for a little bit, Renchi. And let's go ahead and just take a very short, very, very short PSA break to get a word from the Ad Council.
Awesome.
This is Healthcare 411, information for better health. October is Health Literacy Month, a good time to remind Americans that many of us could stand to improve our health literacy skills. ARC Director Dr. Carolyn Clancy explains.
Health literacy isn't just about being able to read. It's about how well a person can find and understand information about healthcare. This understanding plays a big role in how well a person can take information and use it to make good decisions about their care, such as following directions for treatment.
So where can consumers find reliable yet easy to understand health information?
Healthfinder.gov, a federal website designed to help people stay healthy, provides evidence-based health information in both English and Spanish. And this site has recently been improved to make it even easier for consumers to find and use helpful information to better understand their own health.
Healthcare 411 is produced by ARC, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Deborah Jane for Healthcare 411.
And now, on with the show.
Alrighty, listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show with Restita and Robert. And our call-in number here is 347-677-0699. Our special guest tonight is Soke Greg Woolridge. And with all the news and trivia out of the way, let's go ahead and get to the interview. It looks like... We have a caller... there is no number.
I just got texted from somebody who said they just called in.
Yeah, and
we've got a surprise.
Yeah, this caller is calling from, there's no number, they're calling from Vigilante Film. Vigilante Film, thanks for calling the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show.
How you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Eric, how are you?
Pretty good. How you doing? How you doing? It's okay.
Doing good, doing good. How about yourself?
Good. I'm up in the mountains, so I couldn't call any other way but Skype. But I've been listening. It's been very, very informative.
Outstanding.
Right on. When the number popped up, I'm like, who's Vigilante Film? No.
Oh my God,
Eric.
Bam, this is my boy Bama. You want to talk about one of the finest martial artists? Raw dog you're ever going to meet. He's on the line right now.
Right on.
That's right.
Right on.
How's it going out there in the mountains, man? You taking care of yourself?
Yeah, I'm on holiday with the family. We're up in the mountains. I'll be coming down probably in a day or so and have to shave my beard. But, yeah, it's been good.
From the mountain.
Yeah. During the holiday.
Well, you got that lumberjack look, you know, you got that raw power to go with it. So I'm sure you can pull it off.
But, how was your trip? I know you're either back or you're on your way back, or I'm excited.
Yeah,
to
I came back a couple weeks ago from Asia. It was 6 months and, it was an outstanding, martial experience. I was in the Philippines, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam and Singapore, and it was very eye-opening, and it was very humbling at the same time. But it is good to be home. Awesome trip.
So, by the way, how is Out of the Stone coming? I heard great things about it, as a matter of fact.
Oh, good. Everything's good.
It's outstanding. Well, I'm glad you're able to take the time to give a call in, my man. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing you when I get into town.
Yeah, most definitely. I'm glad I was able to catch you. I was stressing for a bit. I didn't know how to do it. Then I realized that you guys had the Skype feature, so I was happy to see that.
We love the Skype feature.
Oh, yes, we do.
We do.
He texted me about an hour ago telling me he couldn't call in, but he'd listen.
Well, I'm glad you're there.
Yeah, the Skype feature keeps everything handy because, you know, when for the longest time I was doing shows from my phone, and if Wi-Fi dropped out or, you know, or if my phone was just being weird, then I would drop calls, and I said, screw that, and I remembered, hey, I can use Skype. So, and it sounds so much better on Skype anyway, so it's pretty cool. And I've started using Skype for the other show that I co-host with, Modern Combat Masters, also, and it's sounding a lot better. So we love Skype. Yes, we do.
You have to thank God for the multimedia environment.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Awesome. Very, very cool. Well, I do look forward to, in the rest of this interview, to be hearing a lot more about your trip. So why don't we go ahead and start with the conversation. And Eric, if I'm going to go ahead and keep your mic on, and just for fun, I'm going to keep up Wrenchy Allen's mic too, so that way if they have questions, they can just come on anytime they want. And of course, you guys can hang up anytime you want too, but we'll make this a big round table. It'll be kind of cool. So Bob, you want to start off the interview?
I do. Sulky, you and I talked today. You really haven't had any jobs that weren't martially motivated in some aspect. Bodyguarding, bouncing, being a cop, air marshal, everything you've done. And you just came back from something martial artists only dream of doing,
mm-hmm.
traveling abroad and training.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, did you find different mentalities over there, open-minded, closed-minded? What was it like training with some of those great masters that you ran into while you traveled?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, the trip was bittersweet. I think that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, in the Western realm, we live in a multimedia environment where we're cross-trained, we read, we have access to different seminars and programs. So as a result of that, I think our martial expression tends to take on a much broader application. What I found, and I'm sure it varies from every person to person, but in Asia in particular, you're in some of those countries, the third world countries, where in some ways that realm of creative thought isn't quite in the same manner as it is in some of the Western places. Access to certain multimedia issues isn't really accessible to many. So what happens is that I found people to be a little bit more very, very good, very, very savvy at what they did, but a little bit more narrow as to the overall expression as it relates to other arts and other aspects of other countries around the world. You know, one of the things that I did come to terms with very quickly was, and I think all of us who train long enough, we began to realize that a punch is a punch, a kick is a kick. It's not about the technique. It's really about the culture and the spirit that motivate and move the art in question within that environment. So, you know, the issue wasn't so much to focus on what the next technique was or what the next approach was. But it really became for me about the people and the food and the history of the environment and really what motivates the people to train and how does that motivation impact their expression as artists. You know, I think I took a lot for granted coming from the U.S. and coming from a progressive Western perspective that, you know, sometimes we think the rest of the world is going to think and be like us.
Right.
And so it kind of gave me a very humbling lesson that, you know, sometimes you gotta slow your roll a little bit. Sometimes you just gotta, you know, take things at face value a little bit more than we might normally do that, and really kind of get to the heart of what the issues are. And mm-hmm. And I think that's where the art was for me. And I think that's what I found was it was bittersweet. There was a great learning process. But as far as trying to find the new answer or the next approach, that, you know, that really wasn't the experience that I had, you know. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be the bittersweet part of it, where I think I had to grow up a little bit. Even though I've been in the martial arts 38 years, you know, there's still that romanticism about Asia and the traveling aspect of it. But there's a theoretical side to that, but there's also a reality side to that. And if you're in a third world environment, their martial art is probably going to be reflective of that third world mentality in a lot of ways. And that's mm-hmm. not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's just a real thing. It's honest.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I'm still digesting quite a bit of what I learned, and which was extensive. But I tell you what, it was beautiful in some ways, and it was stark and eye opening in others. You know, so
mm-hmm.
it was bittersweet in general.
Wow!
Awesome.
What a great thing.
I know.
What was the barrier for your understanding, the language barrier, that sort of thing? What kind of obstacles did you have to jump over?
Well, you know, I think you're going to find that people are people no matter where you go. We have the same concerns, raising our families, taking care of our day-to-day needs, and hopefully taking care of the future of our families. So you're in an environment where people are working every day trying to do that very thing. And, you know, the U.S. dollar plays powerfully in many places. So you'll find that in many places, though there are language barriers, people can communicate and do communicate. But the beauty of the communication process became very martial in the sense of the spiritual connection to people, the tonality with people, the body language with people, the intangible communication that I think when we are kind of the Western perspective, we take for granted. You know, we use many words to explain what our perspective is. But mm-hmm. in Asia, when you didn't have the language, you know, you had to really focus a lot more on your body gestures and your tonality and reading the body gestures and tonality of the people that you're dealing with. So I think it really brought you even closer to the people you're talking with, because you're far more in tune to them. You're not just counting on the words, because that's
right.
really sometimes not enough to get you over. So you have to really look at the whole person, and you're looking at their smiling, if they're frowning, what's their body posture? Are they slumping their shoulders? Are they perked up and they're looking at you? Are they animated with their hands and gestures, or are they very sullen and sedentary? I mean, all of these things play a part in the communication process, and I believe that is at the key of the martial process, because what we do as martial artists is read and impact people. And if we can't touch people beyond the language, then we're really going to miss a great essence of who that person is and what they have to share. So I think the language barrier was a plus. I think it made me look deeper into people. It helped me, it forced me to kind of let go of my kind of, I call it a sense of arrogance, of being able to articulate and use words and language in a certain way, and really get back the basics of just dealing with people on a very human level, on a very simple daily level. And I think people are people. And when you smile at somebody, it doesn't matter where you are, they smile back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the open door, is that we're all fathers, we're all mothers, we're all sons, we're all bosses and employees. You know, we're all students.
Right.
And I think that is, the language was the first thing that woke me up to really, I think, what the lessons were going to be, which was, boy, did I get this wrong if I thought it was going to be what I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be what it was going to be. And it was up to me to open myself to that, to humble myself and to start to listen to people, to start interacting with them, not just on the verbal word, but on the handshake, if they are handshaking, on the gestures and on the voice, and on just the overall body energy. I think it was a powerful experience from that level.
Wow,
very
what
cool.
A great answer. Well, Cecil, I just got texted that we have another caller online.
We do. I was just waiting to find a great time to bring in our next caller. So
I thought
we have
that was
caller.
A good segue for you.
Yeah, it was. We have a caller from area code 951. 951, welcome to the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show.
Well, thank you for having me on. This is Dan Hecht. How are you?
Way! Hey! How are you doing?
Hey, Auntie, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, sir?
Outstanding. Working patrol tonight. Figured I'd pick up the show while I was on patrol. We got some dead time.
Oh,
so,
you know, love talking to cops. Love talking to cops.
Yeah. You know, I was listening to your comments about communication abroad, and as you know, I traveled quite extensively in the military and got and had the benefits of traveling and training in several Asian countries. And, you know, I found the same things that you found. We have a lot here. We look at Asia with awe, but we have a lot of talent in the United States
mm-hmm.
that rivals, and I'm tentative on how I say this, but I don't need to travel abroad if I'm looking for a grandmaster or looking for someone
yeah,
trained
absolutely.
With that's capable and the real deal. We have a lot of that right here. And,
right.
You know, I got to travel abroad extensively, and I love doing it. I love to train with some heavy hitters in South America and Asia, and they are some heavy hitters over there, but we have a lot right here in our own country. So
mm-hmm.
I still would have loved to join you on that sabbatical.
Well, you know, Auntie, and everybody listening, you know, one of the things I believe as just as a simple sensei in the arts is honesty is critical to our growth, and to not to color things when it's not necessary to color them, just to tell it how it is and
right.
be honest about it,
because
right. we're all grown ups and we live we deal and teach in a life and death realm. So, you know, being honest is important for us to keep in mind. But the truth is that if you're training somebody who is raised in a kind of a third world environment, and they are very well schooled at what they do, the challenge for them is getting cross trained in the other aspects of the arts that really may not be that may not have had a chance to be exposed to. And
mm-hmm.
we get exposed to. In this country, we're exposed. It's on TV constantly. We have everybody has a computer here. You know, we go to seminars. There's a school on every corner in the West, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we all have friends that are cross-trained in different arts. So we always have at our fingertips access to a plethora or a variety of martial arts, and that combination of input has a great emphasis in how we develop and who we become. So when you go to Asia and you're looking at somebody who, say, who's grown up and having to work from a very young age, didn't go to school because school wasn't really emphasized and still isn't emphasized in some places, and let's say they grew up in one specific art, they may be fabulous at that one art, and that is something you can glean from them. But when it comes to the other arts that surround that, all of the arts, their exposure may not be where it is with the art they came up in. So they can be somewhat narrow in what they're doing, very good at what they know, but it's only speaking to what they know. And you can't blame them for that because that's a part of the environment. It's a part of the culture.
Yeah.
And just like Hashi said, in honesty, what I learned was that I didn't need to go anywhere to find the answers. They were here already, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the truth was, is for me, is to focus on what people did have to offer. What was that one thing or that two or three things that I could glean from everybody and that I met? And I tell you what, it was in the totality of the contact that I learned, not in one specific meeting or training process that I learned. So I agree with Hashi completely. We have some great, great martial artists here, but we can never take for granted how blessed we are in this country. We have access to so many diverse arts. It just blows my mind, and it blows my mind how I took it for granted when I went overseas.
Could I interject for just a second, guys?
Sure.
Sure.
This is Alan Woodman again. How you guys doing? I appreciate hearing the conversation. I agree wholeheartedly with both senseis and what they're saying. But, a lot of people who know of me know that, I've spent about the last 23 years of my life living over in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And training there. So, the one thing that I think Americans in general don't really comprehend the value of is that they have this wonderful ability to go out and research and discover and train in all these various different arts. And then, being in Asia as long as I was, the last stint was 14 years straight. So,
amazing.
That mm-hmm. for example, in Japan, although you can find them if you spend about a year of looking for them, you can find them, but it's not readily accessible, is that, other schools of thought and other theories and other practices, for example, being there and going to the Hanbu Dojo for Shotokan and Aikido both, when I was offered a chance to teach a seminar at a Taekwondo school in Tokyo.
Beautiful.
It kind of astounded me. I'm not the greatest in the world by any means. And I was kind of curious as to first of all, why do you want me? I mean, there's other great teachers here in Japan and in Tokyo. There's other amazing people, but it's because of the narrowness of the training, and I don't mean the narrowness of the person, but it's the focus of the training of those people that they really don't cross train. They don't they don't really go into other arts. They don't go into other schools to learn something new. The Japanese mentality, and a lot of it is also the Chinese mentality as well, that if you go there, is that you do one art and that's what you're going to stay with.
Mm-hmm.
You may transfer to another art that is somewhat similar, but it might be another art form, but then that's what you're going to do. And there isn't what Americans do, which is kind of like dojo hopping,
I had a different experience. I had a really strong base in Goju-Ryu. I didn't start in Goju-Ryu. I started in our niece in the Philippines. And went and then bounced wherever I was stationed at, is whatever art was being taught there is what I took. But my foundation was in Goju-Ryu, where I learned the real meaning of Budo from Kiyoshi Michael Sanchez. So my foundation, I think, was strong. And that's when I started exploring other arts. Once I had a strong foot, I'm always a Goju guy. But... I had my base.
I think my point, what I was actually saying was that Americans, I think, for the majority, don't really understand the wonderful opportunities that they actually have, because in Asia, it's really sectioned off where people don't cross train, don't really get that opportunity to cross train really. Just because of the culture and the aspect and the focus, like I was speaking of earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
It's a really great thing that we as Americans can kind of, diversify our learning, and we can travel to different schools. And we're interested in that. I mean, that's the thing. We're interested in that.
It's interesting, Sensei. I have deep respect for your journey. 20 years abroad, it blows my mind. It's amazing. And I agree with you. And I think, what we take for granted is, what I took for granted, and I can't speak for anybody else, but I kind of went over there with this kind of arrogant kind of perspective a little bit, thinking that everybody was going to be as well-versed. And that was unfair of me to do that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, and this is the beauty, is that the beauty I found in the arts where I went was really in the people. And it forced me to look beyond the technique. It forced me to look at how, when they cook, how are they cooking? What's the food they're using? When they live their life? How are they with their families? How are they with their friends? Because all of that expresses itself in their art and whatever it is they're doing. And so,
and I'm actually very pleased that you've discovered that. I mean, that is such a huge mm-hmm. evolutionary step for any martial artist to finally comprehend that it's not the art, but the people that
right.
have that art. I mean, that's really
definitely
And what's interesting is, you know, once I had the opportunity, and once I kind of flipped the script on how I was looking at it, it really did shift the entire picture. It just mm-hmm. gave me it was my heart that was impacted, and my brain kind of followed second. And then when you look at how they express their art, it gives you a whole different take on what you're seeing. Instead of looking from our Western mind with the Western critical thinking perspective,
mm-hmm.
you put that aside and you let your heart kind of come out a little bit. You feel the people a bit. And you have an insight into really what's motivating what they're doing. And I think that's really where the power of my experience was. I was only there for 6 months. But it was just enough time to get an honest taste. Because that's what Sensei was saying. I made every effort to find the quote-unquote masters. Let me tell you. that, other than training with Grandmaster Kokoy Kanyete in the Philippines, other than him, it was very difficult finding kind of what I went out there initially to find. Mm-hmm.
Well, did you actually get to spend some time with Master Kanyete?
Absolutely. I spent a little over a couple months in the Philippines.
I had a wonderful opportunity to train with him years ago. What an amazing man.
You know, he's
absolutely amazing.
I was with him on his 93rd birthday. Me and
Grandmaster Cheryl are so jealous. We had just left when you were going, right? And it's missing Grandmaster's birthday. You know, and then, you know, that one day when we called you and you were at Grandmaster's birthday, I'm like, oh, good, you did get there. Okay, good. You know,
we were so jealous.
You were right there. It was so great, and awesome.
Look at something there. Grandmaster Kokoy Kanyete, he was an attorney. He's been 93 years old. He's been in the martial arts 84 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. He's educated, and he's cross-trained, and he's intellectual. He's very in tuned, and he is I just found him very refreshing. Because he was beyond just, you know, being the fabulous tactician that he is, he has such insight into humanity and into people mm-hmm. and into really the humanity of what we do as senseis and how important it is to touch people in a manner that matters, in a spiritual manner. You know, punches and kicks come and go. We get older. We slow down. Things change. Our bodies change. But what always improves is our spirit and our heart and our mind. And working with Master Kanyete. Go ahead.
It's my radio.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh.
I'm on control.
He was the one that really emphasized that.
You know, that's really just an awesome. That's such an awesome experience. And, you know, I've been offered the opportunity to go train at the Balintawak compound in just outside Manila whenever I can get over there next. I would love to do that. And you know, please stay in touch with me and let me know where Master Kanyete is, because I would love to go visit him again.
Absolutely.
He's in a different island.
I've been to the Philippines and several islands there and you know, got to train with the Pikita Tertia group.
Oh, cool.
Wow. And, of course, with Grandmaster Atalia, you know, in the Philippines with Carvajal. But most of my eskrima has been in the U.S. But you know, traveling over there, you do get a different feel for it, and it's not
right. it's not the, you know, I think the best part of traveling outside the U.S. really is to get away from the political correctness that goes on inside the dojos, and which is, mm-hmm. you know, the business that we run here in the industry here in the United States. Because in Asia,
that's
not like
our growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you bring up a really good point, Sensei. That I believe that is the biggest stifling factor in karate schools across the United States.
Right. Yeah.
Is the political correctness garbage that goes on? That
well,
politics
you know, think
itself.
About-
Ugly,
you know,
the ugly side of the politics.
You know, going along with what you just said, and I agree 100%. You know, as a real life artist, somebody who's had to use this in the real world, on the streets, in multiple environments, you know, what I believe is the problem in the West is that connection to that political correctness. You know, we don't say what we think. Because we're afraid we're going to run somebody out some of the times. We're afraid to say what we honestly feel at times because somebody might not like it. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're always dancing on eggshells because we're trying not to make the wrong person upset. And what happens is we kind of lose ourselves along the way. You know, and I think for me it's just about getting back to basics, remembering what's important. It's the student that's important. Our job is to find where their comfort zone is and then keep them about 2 or 3 feet outside of that comfort zone and task them and help them to grow. And but the beauty is that we grow with them. We're all students.
I think another aspect that Asia can benefit, you know, martial arts in its endeavors the way it works now is that, to be honest with you, is that the I think it's they keep the realism of the art whatever they're practicing. They keep the mm-hmm. real roots, traditional roots and value of the art that they're practicing. And I think here in America, you know, I've only been back for about a year and a half now back in the States, but I, you know, I travel a lot and do a lot of seminars and all that. But you know, what I come across is that it seems to be what's really losing and lacking here in the United States is a lot of people have moved away from the realism of the martial arts they practice to do more of what's flashy or to, you know, they want to add, oh, I want to, you know, a Taekwondo styled kick would be better when performing this kata, you know. Or whatever, you know, they want to add or subtract instead of staying the way it is, and I feel that to be the case, sadly, in American martial arts. And not that there isn't realism in American mm-hmm. martial arts, but
mm-hmm.
I feel that that's where it's lacking, and I think that's where Asia makes a difference. If you get to travel to another country and go to Asia,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, they don't care. They don't have insurance for their dojo because if you get hurt, guess what? You came there to their dojo to learn. They're here to teach you.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Don't blink.
Yeah.
This topic, I think, is a topic that needs to be discussed at great length at much more often than it is. You know, the truth is the negative side to the multimedia world is the perception of what the arts are in relationship to what the arts really are. You know, people are watching movies and television, and you watch Texas Ranger, you know, with Norris, who I love deeply as an artist. But the show, it's the typical show of people who don't know the martial arts, when they see the movies and TV and they go to the dojo on the corner that's not really interested in giving them what they need because they want the dollar. It's McDojo time. They sell it.
Yeah. They're giving them what looks good.
Exactly. And the sad issue is if you talk to anybody who is a real combatant, whether he's a military guy, a police officer, a close protection expert, somebody who's doing any merc work or any type of high profile work or bouncing bars, anybody that's putting their behind in the mix is going to know one simple truth: simplicity rules.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it simple.
God bless you, brother. I am so with you on that one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because the truth is, I don't care how much I know, how long I've trained, or how many fights I've been in. If my head isn't correct, I can get killed at any time in any encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And the concern isn't when I'm alone. The concern is when I'm with my daughter or my girlfriend or my mother. I mean, because protecting somebody and defending to protect and defend at the same time, that's not a skill we learn by osmosis. That's what we have to prepare for. We have to think about multiple man defense.
You can learn it by osmosis one time.
Yeah, that's it. One time. Just once.
You know? That's your limit. That's your limit on that type of training. Once.
There's no second chances
after that.
Well, you know, Tiffany, you're all over it because, you know, I think the idea is that, you know, I think sometimes we run too fast in our training and we need to slow down a little bit because when you're taking big strides, you're stepping over a lot of terrain that you need to be taking a look at. Simple things are what work. You know, people talk about punching and kicking as if that's the goal of what a real combatant is focusing on. You know, a good combatant is the guy who's making good threat assessments. He's reading his environment properly. He's making good decisions in relationship to his environment, so he never gets in trouble. It's like being a good bodyguard. If a bodyguard is fighting all the time, he's not a very good bodyguard.
I have to share the story with you, and I think you can relate. Is that you know? Currently, I do security for a couple of places locally here, maybe 3-4 days a week. One establishment that I was working for about 6 or 7 months. During my whole time there, never had one incident, never one. Yet I left. They couldn't afford me. That you know, the economy being what it was, they couldn't afford to hire me. I left, and the owner. I spoke to the owner fairly recently and told me, since I left, he goes, you know, when you were here, we never had any problem. After you gone, now we had like 3 or 4 fights. We had to replace glass. We had to replace a door. We have a hole in the wall. It's like, you know, I'm like, yeah, that's exactly right. Because when we went here, it did not escalate to that.
Security is like insurance. You never want to pay for it. But then when you stop paying for it, that's when things happen.
But
that's how it always
is.
Well, you know what? I get the sense that you're all over it. I think the idea of what really, you know, what this is really about is, I mean, in a scenario, whether I respond with a punch or a kick or an improvised weapon or I got a gun, that's not the issue. The issue is, what have I done in the pre-conflict? Because you've got a pre-conflict, during conflict, and post-conflict issues. And we don't just wake up in the middle of a fight. Either we walked into it or they walked into us. Or we drove into it or they drove into us. But somehow we ingressed into the scenario. The issue is, as artists, we need to start being more cognizant of our surroundings. How are we threat assessing our environment? Are we reading people? How are they walking? How are they talking? What's their body posture? How is their stride? And how is your stride or our stride in relationship to how we're dealing with other people? Are we a victim? Are we sending off the mindset or the signals that we're a victim? Or do we, it's in our control to be preemptive in what we do so that we can at least minimize our encounters. And if it's time to go, that's what we're trained for. No problem. That's what we're built for.
I agree. I actually instruct a few of the people at one of the nightclubs that I'm at, one of the bars, is that I always get, you know, people always go, wow, you're really friendly. You seem to talk to everybody that comes into the bar and stuff. And I said, yeah, I'm not really that friendly. I mean, I'm a nice guy, but, you know, actually, every time someone steps in front of me and I'm looking at their ID, you know, I'm talking to them. Hey, how you guys doing tonight? How's it going? And I'm literally, like you said, I'm assessing them before they even step into the establishment. How intoxicated are they? You know, are they good? What's their attitude? And you can tell, you know, I mean, I'm not talking on deaf ears here, I know. You can always tell someone who just comes in a bad mood or is looking for a fight when they walk in the door.
Yeah.
You know,
well, you know,
come in there and get in a bad mood, he walked in the door pretty much in a bad mood, pretty much, I'd say, 90% of the time.
Well, think about this. You know, we all know this. You know, the simple question, how do we know when a man really wants to fight? It's simple. A man who wants to fight, fights. He doesn't talk.
Nope.
So if I have anybody, if I have an individual who's chipping at the mouth, I'm already aware that if I approach him properly, chances are he'll take me out if I give it to him. If a man wants to go, he's not going to talk. He's going to throw. And I think the reality of that understanding is a powerful reality, because it gives you an understanding that if you get a guy who's running his mouth, you know what, if I come at him the right way, he'll take the out every time. And I think typically it's up to us to make sure we're presenting the right package. And the same thing that Sensei is talking about as a bouncer or a security or as a police officer, this is what I think I want to be able to share with my everyday student, is to help them find their protector inside. Because we all have an inner protector. The problem is many people haven't met their inner protector. So the martial process is a bit of an introduction to themselves, a bit of an introduction to their warrior self. Because the warrior self is a beautiful self. It's artistic. It's poetic. And yet, it can be inflictive, but it can be all of these things. And I think the idea is helping people to take or reclaim some of their personal power, helping them to understand that I don't have to be the toughest guy in the world to make the right decisions and avoid 95% of the issues that I might not have avoided before.
I think you guys would agree with me that, in all honesty, if I can avoid it, if I never had to put my hands on any person whatsoever, I'd be a happy guy.
Absolutely.
You know, hey. If I can talk you out the door, if I could say, hey, come here and talk to me for a second. What's going on? I know you're upset with the bartender or whatever. Come here and talk to me. And I walk the guy out the door, and I say, well, I'm sorry this happened to you, but come back tomorrow, okay? You know, and I don't have to really put my hand on the guy, and the guy gives up and goes, oh, all right, you know, and goes home. You know, that's the way I prefer to work. And in my honest opinion, that's my martial arts. You know, that's where my martial arts comes in. It isn't the, ooh, you know, I want to wrist lock this guy and, you know, take him down or whatever. It's, you know, how can I do this without touching him whatsoever?
Mm-hmm.
It's the real art of fighting without fighting.
Right. That's awesome.
Well, this is a topic. And by the way, you know, I don't think we could talk enough about this topic, because I think this is at the essence of self-defense is really thinking about what is it about people that makes them do what they do. I think the body is a book, and if you learn to read the book, you're gonna always be ahead of the game in how you're reading what that person might be willing to do, because people just don't just act out. They're signs. People always
right.
have signs.
It leads up. It's always leading up to something.
Absolutely correct. The question is, are we aware of it? Are we paying attention? Do we understand how to do a comprehensive assessment? Do we understand how to work in a threat assessment manner based on that comprehensive assessment? Can we work in a manner, can we protect the people that are with us? Do we understand the duality of the protector and the fighter? Because those are not the same thing. The protector is moving somebody out of the danger zone. The protector,
right.
The fighter is engaging at the same time.
I'll share a story with you guys. I was actually bodyguarding for General Jung from South Korea. He was the general of the forces of South Korea at the time, and he had come over to the United States, and I was applied as a bodyguard for him for a couple weeks. And there was one incident where a man who was very quiet was walking around the group, and you know, it was my job to kind of assess as to who would get close to him. And he didn't seem crazy, he didn't seem lunatical, he didn't seem fanatical, he didn't seem, you know, but it was just him being so quiet and
mm-hmm.
him just intently staring at the primary and
yeah.
just, you know, and it was, you know, me talking to two other guards and said, do me a favor, stand on our primary, you know, stand on General Jung's left, if you would, you know. And sure enough, you know, the guy, as soon as they moved over there, the guy kind of lunged in and wanted to hit General Jung, and of course, two guards were there. So
mm-hmm.
it was quickly, you know,
That's case in point of exactly what we're talking about. And you know, yeah. the idea, and what's interesting is that I think what the martial arts are really geared for doing. You know, I don't believe that our job is to teach people how to punch and kick. I think punching and kicking are a tool, just like a hammer and a nail is a tool. It's not the hammer and the nail is not the goal. The hammer and the nail are meant to build a structure.
People just like to use me as the nail, though. That's the problem I'm having.
Exactly. But you know,
pound on me all day.
Well, you know, the idea though is simple, and you're right. You know, it is about keeping people very aware of reading other people, understanding ill intent when you see it and when you feel it. Trust your instincts. Listen to your instincts. When that voice is talking to you, listen to it. It's talking to you for a reason. And helping people in training to better understand their inner voice, because we all have it. And the thing is, people in the West, we get so caught up with the fancy technique, the pretty movement, the jump, spin, hook, kick that we saw on the TV show. Mm-hmm. And that's just not, there's just not a lot of place for that, that way of thinking in the real world. You know, you've got to keep it simple, to the point.
I wrote an article that's actually on, if I can say, on worldwidedojo.com. It's called Back to Basics. And it actually speaks exactly to what you were saying, Cynthia, was that, you know, as last year when I returned back to the United States after such a long hiatus and I was overwhelmingly accepted back into the, you know, martial arts community here in the U.S. and did a lot of seminars, you know, throughout the U.S. and stuff. What I found to be lacking was the basic techniques and the basic fundamentals that were not being taught at most schools and by most students. I had green belts and brown belts who really couldn't honestly perform a simple, you know, rising block in a correct manner. I mean, really, it was really that stupidly simple. And
in a mixed dojo world, this is what we get.
That's been endemic of a problem over the last 20 years, though. I mean,
that article about that, Back to Basics, if anybody wants to read it. It's up on Worldwide Dojo. So,
go ahead, Bama. What were you saying about that?
I was just saying that's been endemic of a problem for the last 20 years, is the basics have been sucked out of most of the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why everybody's trying to start at 10 instead of 1. They're either wanting to start already knowing how to kickbox or already wanting to know how to triangle someone or,
yeah,
let's break something. Let's do a Shionagi and skip, you know, EQ, NQ. Let's just jump straight to the Steven Seagal stuff. There's no basics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I taught a seminar. I was actually teaching a seminar out in Pennsylvania earlier this year to a school that the teacher was actually teaching white belts. And I kid you not, white belts in their first month, he was having them doing board breaking.
What?
Wow. And I was like, brother, you got to stop that. please. I mean, they don't even know how to make a proper fist or even how to hold their hand yet. Like, you know.
Wow. You
need to change
that
up.
Trying to keep people in your dojo. Instead of, it kills me that the strip mall dojos that are trying to keep their doors open by paying the rent, they give so much away without developing the basics, and they get people hurt because they believe that they're capable. And, you know, I can't tell you how many martial artists that I've seen that have an expectation of their capability that is far from the norm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it took me 10 years to get a black belt. 10 years, and I practiced 5-6 days a week. I lived with my instructor for 3 years prior to getting my black belt, from brown belt to black belt for 3 years.
Amen.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived with my instructor, and I got karate 7 days a week. Every waking moment, he woke me up with katanas. So, you know, it is what it is. So, I would never trade that for anything. But we don't have that same type of training anymore. It's one of the reasons I don't have a commercial dojo, is I can't see training somebody from 7 to 8 o'clock at night. You know, 1 hour training session. My warm-ups were an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
going to the dojo for me even was 2-3 hours thing. You know, whenever I went, it was every day or every other day or whatever it was. It's a 2 or 3 hour event at minimum, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I get off work at 4:30 and leave the dojo at 8.
Well, you know,
mm-hmm. it's my training.
You know, what's interesting, listening to everybody is, you know, this is what I love about the arts is that there's a great many people who have paid some very real dues to get where they've gotten. And you know what? If we don't do something within our powers today to keep it real for the future, it's just the path is going to wane down to nothing. You know, these McDojos that pop up on every corner now that you just cut a check for and you get your black belt. You know,
mm-hmm.
the idea is you don't give people what they want. You give people what they need.
Right.
I'm
going to
blow your mind real quick, Greg. You know where that started, don't you?
Where?
That started in the military in Korea. You got a one-year, and I didn't study there. I didn't study in Korea. I trained through Korea when I was in active duty. But I had friends that went to Korea for a one-year assignment, and they trained for 1 year and earned a black belt. I had three people come back that were military folks that earned their black belt in 1 year, and they came back and trained with me in L.A. And, you know, basically I said, you know, you earned that black belt. I'm not going to take it away from you, but here's where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
If you
yeah.
want to progress with me, this is what
I really expect
of you.
I really want to add something to that and verify the statement. If you just give me 1 second, allow me, if that's
sure.
all right, guys. Is that here's the fact. Without a doubt, Korean Taekwondo, Tangsudo, Subakdo, you know, Hwareng, Musul, Kuksul, you know, they are fantastic arts. They have amazing
Almost
techniques. They have great masters. I mean, undoubtedly, it is a phenomenal system that they have there in the country. Taekwondo, Tangsudo, anyone with any true sense of history can tell you that it actually is formulated from Japanese Shotokan. You know, for 36
mm-hmm.
years, it's allowed.
Yeah,
General
Choi did time with a Shoen Ryu instructor in prison.
So here's the deal. Here's the deal. When Korea was trying to, you know, build its country back, one way that they thought to do this was to have the Korean art, Taekwondo, Tangsudo, Subakdo, to basically be amplified, was to have a system that didn't really require use of the art, but knowledge of the art. And that's where that kind of came from, was that if you knew your forms, and you knew your pyong forms, you knew your kyong forms, and you could do them accurately, and you could demonstrate all the techniques that were required of you, you know, in form, then you could promote and pass. And that's
mm-hmm.
where that
yeah.
one two-year policy came from, was that they just really wanted to produce it.
Awesome.
I tell you, my experience in the Korean art was much, much different, because I did something like Greg did, but I was 21. 20, excuse me. I was in the Philippines, and I took my milk of 30 days, and I went to Japan, Korea, and spent 2 weeks in Japan and trained at the base in the Shotokan camp at the base, and then I went to Korea and trained with the Rock Guards, the Rock Army Guards. And I tell you what, that was some real training. That was no joke training. That was you better have your stuff wired tight, or you're going to get yourself killed training. So the my experience in the early 80s to what I recently seen. Now, these two, one was a major, one was a retired captain that came back, a husband-wife team, was completely different than my experience in Korea in the 80s. And, you know, basically, they were good athletes. Don't get me wrong. He was a very good athlete, and she was a very good athlete. But the one-year... And it happened in Japan, too, and I won't mention his name because he's a well-respected karate enthusiast here in Southern California. He earned his black belt in 9 months in Japan, because in his system, supposedly, if you beat a black belt, you are a black belt.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, so you earned your Shodan in 9 months, which took me 8 years to earn. It took me 8 years to earn a Shodan. So
So you earned yours in 9 months, and there's value to that. I don't see it. Now, he has progressed, and he's a very well-respected martial artist today, continues to practice as a worldwide organization, and that's why I'm not going to mention him, because I don't want it to sound like I'm criticizing him, but the way it was brought up, he was a military guy in Japan, and he earned his black belt in 9 months. But he was smart enough to continue his training, find somebody under him, or somebody above him, to develop him and create, you know, create a great martial artist, because he truly is a great martial artist today. But, you know, you can't, the goal shouldn't be black belt. And you see this all across the United States. People are goal-driven, and that's a good thing. Don't get me wrong, but Shodan isn't the end of the goal. That's the beginning of the journey.
Oh, God, no. And,
it's amazing, though, how many people think that Shodan is the end-all, be-all. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I earned my black belt. Goodbye.
I know, right? Why don't we do this, gentlemen? We have a caller that just popped up. Area code 707. Welcome to the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show.
Hello, all.
Hello.
Hello.
I use the Grandmaster Woolridge. How you doing?
I was wondering how long it would take Greg to figure out who you were.
Sensei Dan, how you doing?
Yeah, Robert, how you doing, brother?
How dare you guys try to educate people on the history of the martial arts? Like, dojo's like, you're going to put people out of business. What's wrong with you? No, I'm listening. You guys provide valuable service, valuable information. I agree with your points. One of the points I think that we should discuss regarding martial arts that you briefly touched on is just not just a physical capability, even though we're all goal-driven and we want to get that shodan because we can do this kata and this form and throw this kick correctly. Because when you're 70, 80 years old, I give you that longevity, you may not be as physically crisp. So martial arts, you know, then transforms into a mental
51
thing.
Years old?
Yeah, I'm there already. I get up every morning with a walker. How's that?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I tell you what, if the minute our focal point, I think, the minute our focal point is on the on movement, the minute our goal is on technique, I think we're missing the point of what it's about. You know, and I think it's about when somebody is ill. Can they use what they're learning from the martial way to help heal themselves, to help get themselves together? If somebody's going through an addiction, can the martial arts help them get their lives together? For that person, who cares if they can punch or kick well, if it's high or low, if they can do the splits or not do the splits? You know, I think the idea, you're right, is that this is about, it is about impacting the human spirit and helping us be better people.
I'm going to quote. They have a word for that now. I don't know. It's a new term they've been thinking about creating for this. It's called art. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Exactly. I'm going to quote Steven Seagal. If you guys know about me, he is one of my favorite martial artists. I'm going to quote him, and he says, "A good martial artist knows how to hurt somebody really fast and really quick. But a great martial artist knows how to heal somebody." So I'm going to leave with that. You guys, enjoy your evening. Take care.
Love it. Love it.
I had a great teacher that had a very, very similar statement, which is simply that, you know, if you learn to hurt, you must learn to heal.
Yes.
Right.
In
yeah.
the art. And that encompasses everything that comes with martial arts, you know, the shiatsu and the acupressure, the nervous system, the, you know, the correct body positioning, the eating habits, the correct exercising habits of individuals. You know, it's all encompassing, really.
Hey, right. Soki, I've got a question for you. Soki Greg.
Yes, go ahead.
My brother, I want to know more about your martial experience. I
Our
want to know what your drive is.
Want
I want to know about the air marshal, bodyguarding, copping, your dangerous realm, and your not so dangerous realm. The bodyguarding, was it dangerous? I know you still have to stay on your toes, but we've discussed it. And sometimes being executive protection, sometimes it's a babysitting job because these people don't have hits on them. They have paparazzi. They have other things. I want to know about you.
Before we go there, I want to say goodbye. I've got a radio call. You know, guys, I'm on patrol. So it was a great show, and I look forward to popping in on another one soon. I'll talk to you guys later.
Thank you, Hanshi. Thank you, Hanshi. Take care, brother.
Thanks, Hanshi.
Thanks, Hanshi.
Awesome. Awesome. So our number here is 347-677-0699. Listeners, we're talking to Sokay Greg Wildridge. And if you just tuned in, you guys all missed a wonderful, wonderful discussion about self-protection in general, all sorts of cool roundtable stuff. And we're just going to be getting into Sokay Greg's martial arts experience, executive protection, and so on. So 347-677-0699. We have about 20 minutes left in our show, so feel free to call in. And back to you, CP Robert. And it's okay, Greg.
Talk to us, man. I want to know everything. I want to know everything about your experience.
Well, I would just say, like most of us here, I've been in the martial arts since I was 10, 11 years old. I'm 48 now. But I started bouncing bars when I was 18, 19. And I've either bounced bars, policed, or bodyguarded ever since. So I paid the bills for well over 20 years putting my hands on people. And, unfortunately, as a police officer, I was in several shootings. I've seen a lot from the bar side, from the protection side, and from the law enforcement side. And I haven't seen any more than a lot of people, but what I have learned is that there's one constant that kept me alive, and that was training. That was keeping my ears open and my mouth shut. That was putting in the work, reading more than most, training more than most, going after the environments that were going to give me the education that I needed. You know, I didn't protect the people I protected because I went after them. It turned out they started coming after me based on the training and the price that were paid. You know, this is what people have to understand is that there is no miracle cure to becoming proficient and to moving through the process of mastery, you know, because we never master anything. I think we're always in the living process of being better, getting closer to that mastership. And if we ever get there, I think that's the day you stop learning. But the idea is that for me, from bouncing bars, and I bounced the club scene from Chicago to New York to Los Angeles to Vegas. I worked, from about 18 years old to 25. I worked the underground club scenes, the above work club scenes, started the EP side to the close protection side at 25. Been bodyguarding since, whatever euphemism you want to use for close protection or bodyguarding, and became a cop at 28 and got out and retired out with an injury because of a fire when I was 40. And, and in that time, and I've been bodyguarding since leaving law enforcement. And the idea is that the price of the street is unyielding. There's no room for half steps. There's no room for the philosophical platitudes. You know, you better act or you're going to get killed. And you better act or your client is going to get killed. Unfortunately, I've done protection for a celebrity that I'm not going to mention his name. He got killed the day after I left him. After I spent, the last three months of his life with him when he was on the West Coast. And that was a hard pill to swallow because the idea of being a sensei and being an artist has always been about giving back, making a difference, helping those who can't necessarily protect themselves, helping them to protect themselves, and if they can't, doing that protection for them if necessary. So for me, I look at self-defense from the perspective of a very simple street warrior, that I have to threat assess in a certain manner to survive. I have to communicate with my team or with the people around me in a certain manner to survive. I have to train in varied approaches whether regardless of what I may run into, because we're going to run into everything on the street, guns, knives, multiple men. You think about self-defense. You think about four basic realms of self-defense: long distance, gap, body on body, and the ground. How I move from one to four, from four back to one, from the ground back up, from out into the body on body position, how I use improvised weapons, how I deal with everything that I can possibly deal with. These are the things that define who we are. How do we train? Are you studying? Are you reading? Are you making the effort to go after the instructors who might have some information for you to help you get to that next place? You know, if you want to do executive protection, are you going after the people that are doing it? Are you training with the people that are proficient in it? If you want to be a police officer, are you training in it? I'm still a defensive tactics instructor for law enforcement. And I'm a use of force expert in the court, so I handle court cases as well when it comes to use of force. There is a comprehensive psychology that accompanies the martial process. And I think the idea is making sure that you always remain a student, that you cross-train in as many things as you can, but you got to find your one or two things that you're going to focus on. You know, you master one, but I believe in cross-training in many. You can't, you know, there's a lot of things out there you got to be able to know how to do today. If you're a modern-day warrior, you do need to know how to deal with a knife. You need to know how to deal with a gun. You need to know how to deal with multiple men. You need to know how to drive a car. You need to know how to threat assess appropriately. You need to understand, if you're a cop, how to search. If you're a bodyguard, how to handcuff and search, and how to do all these different things that typically one place isn't going to give it to you. You know, so you have to be able to keep your mind focused on where you're moving, yet not too scattered where you're dojo bouncing and you're not learning anything. And that can sometimes be a difficult recipe to find. Where's that balance? You know, how much time do I stay focused in my main art? And then how do I supplement that main art with other perspectives to help round me out in a manner that's going to allow me to be the best that I can be in whatever environment I'm in? See, and in all honesty, for me, I look at self-defense not as winning or losing. It's living and dying. In the real world, you fail, you die. That's it. There is no tomorrow. We can't go to Sensei and say, Sensei, it didn't work. Can you help me? It's not the UFC. With some guy, the UFC champion, where he's wearing gloves in the ring with a referee there to stop him and a corner guy there to give him input when he needs help. In a dark alley or in a dark parking lot, Sensei's not there. Your corner's not there. A man pulls a gun, and I've taken 10 or 11 guns off people in the real world when they were trying to yank them on me. And I can tell you, there was nobody there to help me but me or my partner. So,
I need to learn all this in a year, though.
Oh, my God. Oh, you know, and that's our challenge. And you know what, by the way, Sensei? You know, I love those kind of people, though, because I think they're open to being talked to. They're open. Yeah. They're open to being moved in the right direction. And that's our gift as senseis. It's the student's job to come. They don't know what to expect. They've never done it before. So they're coming to us with all these expectations. It's up to us to help move them down the path and put them in a position so that they can make good decisions that are going to get them where they want to go. And that means testing them and challenging them and saying no at times. And you're not going to do this. And you're going to do it this way. I just think that, you know, when you think about the martial arts, I don't care what the system is. I love all the systems because I think every art expresses differently with each practitioner. So the idea is, what has that practitioner gone through in life? And based on what he's gone through, or she, what and how are they sharing it back to the world? And so, you know, I think about, I mean, I'm not sure if that was what you were thinking about, but that's kind of my answer to the question.
Okay, it's crazy. You bring back all the memories, because I was actually on that detail with you that you were talking about before we even knew each other.
Yeah, you know what? That's right. Isn't that a trip?
Yeah.
Eric, isn't that a trip?
That's crazy.
It is. Oh, my God.
Wow.
I was there right beside you. Oh. I was there right beside you before I even knew you. We both worked that detail.
Amazing. You know?
Very cool. And you know what,
Sean, Eric, you know, and everybody, you know, what I think the impact that I want to share with everybody is that there is a price to the warrior life. You know, it's not a book where we just go in punching and kicking and everything works out like we want it to. Sometimes we work and dedicate our lives and people still get killed. Sometimes we work and dedicate our lives and we have to kill. Sometimes we work and dedicate and we see and go through things that are hard to deal with.
Yeah.
And that's another aspect of the arts that's not talked about a lot. And, you know, part of the trip for me going to Asia and Eric, you know, Master Eric will tell you, was trying to go through a little bit of a finding myself process because of all the warrior crap that I've been through. And I was taught how to inflict. I was taught how to dominate. I was taught how to kill and to rip and tear and to do things to people. But you know what I wasn't taught? I wasn't taught how to process the violence afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot of people to go to find out, hey, what do I do with this now? Okay, I just got into a shoot. I just shot this guy. Okay, what do I do with this? I'm not going to go talk to – am I going to talk to a departmental shrink who's going to tell my command staff everything that I tell her? You know, what I'm going to do is I don't want anybody to know I have a problem, so I'm just going to shut my mouth. I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm going to choke it down. And what happens is, as warriors, we begin to choke down the violence that we go through. We tend, every time you're on a detail or your bodyguard and you have to put your hands on somebody or you're whatever the violence may be, it all adds up. And what happens as senseis, we don't teach our students how to process that. We teach them how, we send them out into the world with these skills. We say, hey, go punch and kick, go conquer, go do your thing. But when they come back a little bit broken, a little bit jaded, and they say, can you help me? We don't have answers for them. And I think this is where we need to find change, is that we need to start taking responsibility in totality for our students. If we can teach them how to kill, we can certainly help them process, once they've killed, what they've gone through. We may not be able to change anything for them, but we can be a sounding board for them to start asking the right questions. So, you know, I think as a warrior, I think it's not just about what we did on the streets. Or me and Bama, Eric Thompson, and the things that him and I, matter of fact, Eric and I did quite a bit of work together. And you want to talk about a guy who talked about bouncing, the man on the radio right now, Eric Thompson, who I call Bama, you know, he bounced for years. This guy's been thousands of times in hands-on encounters. I mean, you look at the impact of what we all go through, and it needs to be addressed. It has to be addressed in the training, the psychology of conflict. How do we process all of these issues amidst the training process itself? And that, I think, is the dilemma, one of the dilemmas that we are faced with in a commercial McDojo environment. It's deep, it's heavy, and people just don't know how to broach it. But we are still sending people out into the world to put their lives on the line, to take other people's lives. And you know what? We do nothing for the aftermath. And I think that's a travesty. And I think it's something that deserves a lot more discussion because they're intrinsically tied. The application and the aftermath are opposite sides of the same coin. And we can't teach for one and pretend the other doesn't exist. So I'm not sure if that makes any sense to everybody.
That makes a lot
definitely.
Of sense.
Definitely. Yeah,
it's very important.
Except the only thing I've got to point out is that you're one of the very few individuals that understands and that can teach that.
Well,
it's not in the realm that's understood.
I think everybody understands it, Sifu. I think everybody understands it in different degrees. I think what happens is we all just don't take the time to look at it. We don't take the time to step back and say, wait a second. You know, how can I help this friend of mine who's a martial art brother of mine who just came back from the sandbox, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or how I help a buddy of mine like I just did who just shot and killed somebody, okay? And now he's going on a stress retirement possibly, and he's not sleeping. He's not talking to his wife. He's not doing anything. Nobody, he wasn't talking to anybody, but he talked to me. And the idea is why did he talk to me when he couldn't talk to anybody else? And I think that the idea is that that's the martial power. I think if we start touching people's lives in this manner, that yes, we teach you to punch and kick. Yes, we help you to be stronger. Yes, we do these things. But we're also here to help you work through your challenges. If it's alcohol, if it's a drug addiction, if it's anger addiction, if it's a sex addiction, I don't care what the addiction is. The martial way should be a tangible tool for a sensei to help everybody that comes into their realm. We may not be able to change their lives, but we can certainly put them on the right path so that they start asking better questions.
Mm-hmm. Hey, awesome.
I agree with that. What an awesome answer. So out of all the martial positions that you've held, this is a couple, twofold question. What was your most fulfilling martial position? And when it comes to being a cop, what didn't you like about the position, whether it was the violence towards women, the drug addiction, the gang members? Because you worked in one of the most violent cities in Los Angeles.
Yes. Well, I was a defensive tactics instructor as well. And one of my issues and most frustrating things has always been the issue of vicarious liability. Meaning that you can't really train the way you really need to train because the agencies are typically concerned with people getting injured in training and or them getting sued for some application of force. So what happens is instructors out there are mandated just by the nature of the liability environment to really give people what the management kind of wants, not exactly what they need.
Definitely not what the officers on the street need to know, but what the administrators in the offices want them to know.
Yeah, you know what? And it's a tough line. And by the way, I'm not pointing the finger at the command staff and management of law enforcement. It's a tough line to walk, but it's a very frustrating line to walk because I'm also a use of force expert in the courts. I handle court cases from beginning to end, and from testifying to depositions to the whole caboodle on the applications of force. And what happens is that these guys go out there and they use force that they're either shown, and what happens is when it goes wrong, they get tossed to the wolves. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot that the police departments don't do in preparing their people. And there's a lot that they could do and they should do, but they really don't. And so it was very, very frustrating. And so as a DG now, as a trainer now, still, now that I'm not attached to a PD, I'm have much more freedom to teach in a manner that I think is appropriate. But I think that's probably the environment that's most important to me as well, is because I think these are the guys that answer our 911 calls. And they are important. They matter. And they need efficient, simplistic concepts that work, not one time, but every time. And the idea is you can't just focus on technique. You've got to focus on the psychology. And those two things have to come together. I'll give you an example of what I'm saying. All right? If I were talking, and one of the things I teach people is I say, if you're in some defense scenario, you do everybody. You DDO. You dominate. You dictate. You overwhelm. Okay? I'm not the guy that says go with the flow of things. All right? This is my world. If I'm out in the street and you're stepping at me, this is not a duality. This is my world. I'm letting you live it. Mm-hmm. So you're going to do what I – that's it. There's not a duality here. I'm going to make it happen. The psychology of this is a bit intense. But as a police officer, I can't go into a police environment and teach that. I can't use the verbiage. I can't tell somebody that somebody comes at you and they throw on you, to dominate that individual in the appropriate manner. That term dominate can't even be used. Mm-hmm. The term is not even allowed in that environment, even though the psychology of the term is what I'm trying to get across. The psychology is a difficult thing to pass on. Technique only goes so far. If a person is scared, I don't care what you teach him, it's not going to work. If somebody is punch shy, I don't care what he knows, and if you punch him in the face, he's going to drop. He's punch shy. Mm-hmm. So you have to put people in environments that test their boundaries, that question their perspectives, and get them thinking just a little bit differently. So, you know, the idea, that's a frustrating reality in the professional use of force environment, is that what is needed does not fit what they're being taught, because the technique is secondary to the psychology. I don't care what you know. If your mind is not on point, if you are not clear about what you are there to do, if you are not prepared to put your life on the line, period, today's a good day to die. If you're not ready to go there, there are some jobs people shouldn't take. That's
right.
My humble opinion.
Right?
Awesome. Awesome answer. I hate to cut this short, gentlemen, but we've only got like 4 minutes left on our live stream. Where did the 2 hours go?
Wow.
See, didn't I tell you we could get through 2 hours?
So
no problem. Yeah, I looked up at the clock and I went, what?
Well, you know what's funny, Cecil? Well, you know Greg can talk. Every time I'm on the phone with him, and I'm on the phone for an hour and a half, 2 hours, my wife just comes out and asks me, who are you on the phone with? All I have to do is, it could not even be Greg. All I have to do is say I was on the phone with Greg, and it's understood at that point. That's why I was on the phone for 2 hours.
It's the same thing in my house.
Oh, that's wrong, people. Yeah. That's cold-blooded.
Hey, am I still on the line?
Yeah.
This is
Dan.
Am I still here? Okay, I put you on mute and handled my radio call so I could listen. So that was
cool.
A great answer, Greg. That was a great answer. As a defensive tactics instructor, I completely, and I'll have a cold one with you and discuss it in more depth, because it's still the same thing. You haven't left anything. It's still the same process that's going on every agency across the United States. It's a check mark for our administrators instead of real training.
It's sad.
So,
it's a sad reality.
I think it'd make a great subject for another show. In fact, you know, because...
Oh, I did my master's thesis on this. I did, USC, I did my master's thesis on martial arts and arrest and control. How martial arts impact arrest and control. It was a great thing. So
I would love to do it.
I'd love to have a conversation about that. I'd love to.
Yeah, I think it'd be great because you know, this 2 hours went by too quick, and you know, I was just sitting here thinking, you know, it'd be great to get this group together again and talk about, either that martial arts and how it relates to law enforcement, or even, you know, the subject of retaining the student versus retaining the art. So, you know, the whole marketing junk, you know, and stuff like that. So I think, you know, either one of those subjects or both with this particular group would be wonderful.
I think that'd be a great idea for one of our forums.
Yeah, I think I think
you
in a couple
really
weeks
about
we have
that,
our next
that
forum.
Whole concept about saving the student versus the marketing aspect of it. Look at the MMA dojos right now. The grind them up, pound and ground, ground and pound dojos. They're busting out at the seams, and they're training hard. There's a hunger for that. There is a real hunger for real hard training. And, you know, it is amazing to me that traditional martial arts schools aren't picking that up and saying, oh, if you want that, we can give that to you. So there is a real hunger for that.
Yeah, well, I think it would be really good.
I just want to add, I wanted to add one thing to all the senseis there. I was a training instructor for the Bakersfield Sheriff's Office under Commander Harris a number of years back. You know, I said it then, I'll say it now. I think in most cases, I think police officers, in all honesty, and law enforcement, on the street law enforcement individuals are probably some of the most undertrained for the position that they have.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely. That's why I think this particular subject would be really great for a future episode. I think it'd be great.
Well, real quick before we have to leave, you know, Sulky Greg, you and I talked about a part two because I knew this was going to happen. Are you up for a part two show?
Absolutely. If you have me back, I'll be on.
It's going to be free the second or fourth,
show, guys.
Fourth of Sunday in January.
Sounds good. You got me.
All right. So, I think me or Bob will get a hold of you about that. Okay. And I want to thank all of the great callers. that called in today, Renchi Allen Woodman, Hunchy Eric Thompson, Hunchy Dan Peck, Master Robert Parham, everybody, and of course, thank you so much, Soke Greg, and we hope to have all of you, as well as Soke Greg, on for part two on one of these cool subjects that we talked about today. So thanks for listening, everybody. We talk to you all next week. Have a great night, everyone.
Take care, my brother.
See you guys later.
Awesome.